Achieving regenerative outcomes in agriculture is the result of how we live, how we think, how do we know and learn, how do we apply knowledge and wisdom. For knowledge alone, without the wisdom to use it properly, is simply a weapon of mass destruction.
Our food systems are broken. Broken by a half century of extractive practices and a mentality of working against rather than with nature. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Never before has there been more consensus that our food systems need to be radically reimagined, and the mandate is urgent. There are many different visions out there for what the changes should look like, many that are business as usual masquerading as technological innovation. Today, we are talking about regenerative agriculture, a truly transformative paradigm rooted in ancient knowledge rather than new technology. My guest is Reginaldo Hazlett-Marroquin, CEO of the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance. Rehi sees regeneration as a healing journey, one that starts as healing within, before we can turn to healing our relationships with the people and places and ecosystems around us. Rehi has an infectious optimism that will convince you that radical change is possible. Let's dig in. Today, I am joined by a leader in regenerative agriculture and food systems innovation, Reginaldo Hazlett-Marroquin. Rehi is the president and CEO of the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance, which is a community of farmers, public interest groups, businesses, cooperatives, tribes, elected officials, all of whom are committed to collective impact for addressing and transforming, I think, our food systems. Rehi's book, In the Shadow of the Green Man, is really an essential piece of reading, I think, on how we can learn from our past and develop new wisdom for transforming food systems. Rehi, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here with you.
Rehi, can we start by talking a bit about the problem? Our food systems are broken, I think it's fair to say. And you know, as somebody who's worked on food systems issues for, I guess, 16 or 17 years now, I see both tremendous challenges, but also more attention than ever, or more agreement than ever, that we need to do something radical, that we need to change things in radical ways. Now, that being said, there's lots of different visions out there for what that looks like, what kinds of changes are necessary or possible, what the future of food should look like. Can we start by talking about the emergence of one of these new storylines, regenerative approaches, regenerative agriculture? I'm really curious to hear how you define regenerative agriculture.
Let's start with your last piece. How do we define? Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. We don't. In fact, it's fundamental for achieving a regenerative outcome to not define it, to not reduce it to our myopic understanding of things, to our limited ability to see the world, to our limited senses, to the limitation of our colonizing mind, our straight line engineering processes. It's critical not to define it. Rather, what we do is we seek to understand what is and what isn't regenerative. And from that context, we use in order to do that, we use a very simple and yet time-tested ancestral way of thinking. So to us, achieving regenerative outcomes in agriculture is the result of how we live, how we think, how we process things, how do we know and learn, how do we apply knowledge and wisdom. For knowledge alone, without the wisdom to use it properly, is simply a weapon of mass destruction, as proven by the over 83,000 chemicals that were developed so-called for the purpose of agriculture and for the so-called idea that that is how we feed the world. It's exactly the contrary. It's how we destroy the world for none of those 83,000 chemicals in the current system. Not a single one was designed to give life, but to take it away. And so, no, we're not going to define what regenerative is, but we will tell you, how do you know if you are regenerating or not. Number one, you have to understand that the concept of agriculture and food to begin with, what is broken isn't the system of food and agriculture as it exists according to its geo-evolutionary blueprint. What is broken is the way as humans have sought not to engage those processes, which are absolutely magnificent, but how we have come into that space to colonize it and to extract and to use the fact that we need food every day as a way to extract the wealth of the planet. That is what is broken. It's our humanity that is broken. But the natural processes by which energy is transformed from non-edible forms into edible forms through those biophysical and chemical processes defined by the laws of thermodynamics in a short sentence, those processes are alive and kicking and trying to make their way through the incredible disruption and abuse and colonization imposed by our human behavior. It is us who are broken.
Thank you for that answer. I feel that answer in so many ways, and so I appreciate it. The listeners they'll be able to hear in your answer a lot of excitement. They won't see you smiling the way you do when you delivered it. And I say that because you've just described really big problems with a smile on your face. So something tells me that you are optimistic and hopeful, and you're so clearly passionate about this work. Where does that come from?
Just so you know, I've been told to put a more serious face when I'm talking about serious issues, because it almost looks like I'm enjoying the fact that things are screwed up. It's not the case. It's just, what are you going to do? Remember, if you know my history, I grew up in a war and all of that. I mean, if we had allowed for the conditions around us as impossible, hopeless as they looked like, if we had allowed them to take over our mind, our bodies, and our spirits, we would have dwindled, shriveled up, and died a long time ago. I am not that kind of person. And yes, I'll be smiling because for every situation we see that is happening, what I see is a huge opportunity for us humans to change and to finally see the light, smell the coffee, wake up, and actually start freaking doing our job and start behaving more like humans and less like irrational bacteria.
Do you have a good example, a good grounding example of maybe a group that you've worked with or something that you're working on, something that can help people see the optimism in practice, the win-wins, if we get back to work, to use the words you just used?
Yes, I think I have to go back to the concept of, okay, so yes, we still have to understand what regenerative is and how it actually happens, where it's coming from, where it came from. It is actually one of the oldest ways of being and seeing and knowing and acting and relating. And it has been preserved. Those kinds of ways have been preserved by Native communities around the world who continue to practice the indigenous ancestral ways. There are literally hundreds of thousands of communities who have continued to practice everything from what is now called agroecology, agroforestry, or others are now starting to call regenerative. Those are not new things. In fact, most of what is written has been copied from the songs and the writing and the stories of indigenous communities in their native territories across the world. And so here in the United States, we have Native communities we're working with down in Iowa and Kansas, here in Wisconsin, in Guatemala, in the highlands. We're talking about a few thousand communities who, despite being displaced from their lands way back in 500 years ago by the Spaniards and being pushed into unproductive hills and all of that, despite all of that, that landscape continues to be vibrant and continues to hold biodiversity, while in the South Coast, where the most productive lands are, which were taken over by the Spaniards, everything has been obliterated. It's now ecological deserts. So we're not talking just about, growing corn, soybeans in a different way. We're talking about actual regenerative as an ancestral concept that defines how we relate to all other living systems on the planet. Somebody said to me the other day on a presentation where said, oh, well, I can't do anything with that. They meant, I can't grow corn and soybeans with that. That's what they meant. So what I said was, listen, what happens is the way you think and live, all of those fundamental principles of regeneration, those define then what you actually do on the land. And so whether you're going to do no-till or go organic and start your path towards regeneration, it needs to be the result of a process by which you actually transform and first regenerate your ability to be human in the full extent that we are designed to. And then everything else is clear to you because you are not going to put chemicals in the land anymore. You're not going to deforest the hills. You're not going to plant monocultures. And as a result of that, you're going to achieve incredibly greater energy transformation. And as a result of that, more food harvest, more energy expressed in the form of foods that you can harvest and eat, share, sell, market, brand, distribute, and build companies out of. That is how regeneration happens. But it isn't because you define it, it's because you understand.
Why do you suppose so many people are, I would say, aggressively skeptical or aggressively critical of whatever you want to call it, agroecology, food systems based on long traditions of ecological knowledge and practices? For better, well, not for better or worse, for worse, I think, so it always gets boiled down to, it can't feed the world. It doesn't grow enough food. Whatever the reason is, there's a lot of aggressive disbelief, we'll call it for now. Where do you think that comes from? And how do you approach it?
Well, I don't know if I call it disbelief. It's something more profound than that. It shows up in different shapes and forms, but it's like the boogeyman, you can never quite nail it. But the thing is, before we developed the so-called Green Revolution and all of these new ways of extracting wealth out of the planet, we actually had more food ready to be harvested than we have now. For example, before all the bison, over 60 million heads of bison in the Midwest were killed off. I mean, remember, the very people who are now saying that these systems won't feed the world are the ones who destroyed the systems that were feeding the world at a scale much larger than we can achieve today. Yes, I mean, we can harvest hundreds of thousands of bushels of corn and soybeans with a single machine. But the energy footprint of that is so many times greater than the energy footprint that it took to generate tenfold or even more food through the original systems that were on the same exact landscape. So no, the way to feed the world is to actually stop destroying the very foundational ecological blueprints on which we depend to actually feed the world. So this is not an issue of belief or disbelief. It's an issue of blatant, plain ignorance on one side, where people don't have bad intentions. And it is completely the defense of a system that continues to expropriate resources, appropriate the stories, and extract the value of the planet as a way to enrich a small sector of the population. That is what is being defended.
You've mentioned a couple of times wealth, extracting wealth, and there's a link there for me between wealth and power to change. And you work in American agriculture, you know how captured it is in terms of who owns the land, who owns the capital, large agribusiness controlling seed. I wonder, is it just that we're unwilling to make those changes, or are there other barriers that are holding people back, whether it's holding back how they see the problem or holding back people who want to do things differently?
We are born both indigenous and colonizers. So when you're born, you are off the earth. You are mostly carbon, water, and nutrients, micronutrients, and so on. There's nothing in your body that did not come from the earth. You are indigenous to the earth, period. But you also are born an organism that evolved over millions and millions of years into survival modes and into fighting for its own, the own perpetuation of its species. That's who we all are, all organisms. Organisms are like that, us included. And so when we come into this space, what we have done for the last 3,000 years, according to some researchers like Sherry Mitchell, Native community members who have actually looked at this far enough back, for about 3,000 years, we started to only feed the colonizer in us. And we stopped and we slowed down the building and the sustenance of the indigenous, our indigenous part. And so this colonizer mentality and ways of being, which is the pattern and the process to the ultimate dictatorship structure, is really what is in the way. Because all of us yearn to be a dictator. All of us, because that is the part we have been feeding for way too many generations. If we want this to change, we have to start raising children who are raised more on the indigenous being than the dictator colonizer being that we are feeding today. And as we do that, yes, we will change, but that's where it starts. Now, some of us, we're lucky and blessed to have been raised that way. Some others were not, but at least they were not completely infected with the virus of colonization. And so though they are starting to grow up and come of age and be confused, they don't understand what's going on. They see a planet either being flooded, being bombed, or being burned, and overheating, and food scarcity, and all of these pandemics. All of that stuff, and it's scary, right? But they have not been presented with a framework of why things are the way they are. And so we, you and I discussing this, need to put it out for everyone to hear that we have a point of departure. Every one of us, this very moment, can be your point of departure. And sometimes, for many, it's a single act of disobedience, a single act of rebellion, a single act of stop feeding the beast. And when we start doing that on a larger scale, we will find that the beauty on the other side of that fence is so endless. The wealth is actually so abundant, nobody has to go without.
I really appreciate in that answer how much you centered individuals and everybody's not just ability to, but the need for people to, and you said this earlier too, to start by sort of reclaiming our humanity and the regenerative aspects or responsibilities of our humanity as individuals, as families, the link between parents and children there also really resonated with me. One of the things that I struggle with is working at an agriculture university, for example. I know a lot of really well-intentioned people who see a problem and have dedicated their life to fixing it, even though they are pushing in a direction that is vastly different from perhaps the direction I would push. There's a, you know, a lot of emphasis on, you know, quote unquote, new technology, whether it's, you know, things we do in a lab. And I expect that your answer to this question is going to be very much linked to the last answer. But I'm trying to find a way to engage with people who are sort of captured in this notion of technology they have as that we need something new to solve the problem. And perhaps an inherent skepticism that anything that's not new could solve the problem.
There's a lot of memes about this, by the way. It's really fascinating. So somebody comes up and says, and puts this picture of this tube, this machine in the desert that that captures CO2. And they said, well, we have solved the problem of capture of CO2 and technology, right? Somebody else says, well, nature figured that out quite a few billion years ago. It's called a tree, man. we talk about, you know, well, fake meat, I guess, is the only way I can call it. It's either meat or it's not. You know, if it's plant-based protein, it's plant-based protein, right? The natural systems develop perfectly fine and sophisticated and absolutely magnificent ways of making meat protein. Also vegetable protein. I don't have to make a vegetable protein. All you have to do is eat so many different products, from beans, all the legumes, to hazelnuts and Brazil nuts. I mean, there is such a massive diversity of vegetable proteins that are ready to be eaten. You don't have to be assembling, you know, square mile, you know, factories somewhere in Sweden or whatever to actually deliver some of the most sophisticated non-animal proteins to the world. But the thing is, to do that, you have to use the systems that are free for all of us to access. And you can't extract as much wealth out of the rest of the communities if you are not controlling that process. It's about control. It's, again, it's about colonization. It's not about feeding the world. It's about using the fact that we eat so that somebody can make more money with technology. Because a tree, you can sell a tree, of course, but you can't sell the processes by which it does what it does. And so the inability to extract that wealth, they haven't figured out how. So let's eliminate everything that will do things for free so that we can then sell the technology that will do it artificially. That's really what we're talking about. It's not about solutions. It's about capturing the imagination of people who don't understand what's going on yet, and making them pay for stuff that we don't need.
Yeah. Related, I think, is that often the commercialized or technological solutions that seem to capture, as you said, people's imagination also just really focus on just one part of the issue, the productive capacity, or maybe the ecological, you know, the carbon footprint. But there's a real important piece I don't want to miss here. As you said, you're absolutely right. Regenerative approaches are not new, but there's clearly more attention to them right now than there has been since I've been working on food. But there's an important social component to them as well. I mean, it's not a component, it's integrated, that improving people's lives, improving people's well-being, addressing rights issues. I'm just curious to hear how you think about the interrelationships of solving human social problems and ecological problems.
Think about it this way. We are the problem. We are the ones who created the difference between the pay for a worker in the field and the pay for the top executive of that same company that makes money and extracts the wealth out of the land and the people in that very field. We are the ones interfering with the photosynthetic processes of the earth that are responsible for arguably one third of all the energy transformation. And so as a result of that, we're squandering so many photons that are no longer, you know, transforming, you know, thin air into valuable foods. That's on us. It's people. We are the ones who built the extractive systems that are cutting down those forests and putting animals in confinement. And so to the extent that we are going to talk about the emergence of a new way of thinking that is more consistent with the ancestral ways that always delivered us, by the way, today, over 80% of the biodiversity on the planet in less than 20% of the landscape is because native communities that continue to practice indigenous ways have continued to do so. That's why we still have that. If it was up to the colonizing system, this planet will be cooked.
Right.
Right. And so it is as we change as a society, that the landscape changes. It doesn't happen the other way, unfortunately. We are completely capable of acting in a way that fixes all of these problems in the planet, just as much as we have been able to imagine and implement the systems that are destroying the planet and our society. We are capable of either one of them. Is a matter of choice, whether we choose to be colonizers or live more from our indigenous nature.
So building on that, I ask this question in one way or another to everybody that comes on the show. What is the most radical change that you'd like to see unfold in your lifetime?
Well, if we go to the top of the radical changes, I think we have to indigenize and decolonize. If we indigenize our ways, we will become more of an expression of our human ancestry, who we are designed to truly be here. Rational beings, not this virus that we have become that is eating the body that feeds it. And it looks like from that perspective, we are bent on eating it up until we ourselves collapse. And that's the behavior of viruses, not rational species, which we consider to be. So that would be one absolutely radical thing that I think we should start working towards at a larger scale we can. And then, you know, as we indigenize, then obviously we're going to stop and slow down and eventually stop extracting and accumulating the wealth of the planet. Instead, we'll start collectively managing it so that we can all do better. And that is also completely doable. There's plenty of wealth for everyone on this planet, and there won't be any new wealth. The wealth of the planet was decided many, I don't know if it's billions of trillion years ago when the planet was formed, and it hasn't increased very much. It's the same. We're just extracting it now. And some are accumulating for their own benefit at the expense of the rest of us and at the expense of the planet itself. That would be the two most radical things we could ever do. And yes, we can live on a very, very different planet. It's not utopical. It's just as real as our ability to build it the way we have it now. Now the reality is just as good.
Thank you for that, Rehi, and thank you very much for taking some time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. I am impressed by the steadiness of your character. I didn't get you more excited than the minute we started, which is fascinating, because I was talking to people who either get really offended and triggered and walk away, or get excited. And you were such a steady, solid platform that I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Today we heard from Reginaldo Hazlett Marroquin, CEO of the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance. You can find links to more about Rehi and his work in the episode notes. This episode of the Second Transition podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washu people in what is now known as Northeastern California. This podcast is supported in part by the Arrow Food Institute and in part by VoiceEd Radio. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.